6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly. And good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair here on WORT. My name is Norman Stockwell. I'm your host today. And today, a two-part program, both parts about the economy in different ways. In the first half of the show, we're going to be speaking with Hugh Sinclair, author of the brand new book, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. The second half of the show, we'll be speaking with Dennis Marker, the book, 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves. So that'll be starting after 12:30. But right now, very pleased to have joining us by telephone Hugh Sinclair and the brand new book, again, from Barrett Kohler Publishers, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic. Hugh Sinclair, welcome to WORT.
Hi, Norman. Good morning.
Very pleased to have you with us. So let's just start off with a little bit of your background. You worked in the microfinance industry with a number of different global organizations, and in fact, you still have some connections with that industry, but tell us a little bit about your history.
Well, I'm an economist by training, and I worked for a number of years in investment banking before I joined the ill-fated Enron shortly before it collapsed. And at that point decided that it might be better to try a different branch of finance and something that could hopefully be more helpful for actually alleviating poverty. So I left mainstream finance and moved to Mexico and began my first work in microfinance. And I've basically been working in the sector for about a decade, based predominantly in South America, in Mexico, in Mozambique, Mongolia and Holland.
And your drive to do this was as you said, to find some place where you could do good with your economics background. What did you find?
Well, initially, microfinance seems to be a very wonderful solution to the problem of poverty. Provide reasonably priced loans to entrepreneurs to work their way out of poverty. This is the mission that Muhammad Yunus cemented when he won the Nobel Prize in 2006. And it's a good mission and it's a good idea. And there are many cases to this day that demonstrate that this does in fact work in some cases. But what I discovered was that the theory of microfinance, the presentation that we give to the outside world, is very romanticized. It's very glorified. And in actual fact, the reality is very different. So when I was initially in Mexico, what I discovered was, for example, that a large amount of the money that we were lending wasn't going to entrepreneurs at all, but it was used as consumer credit and at very high interest rates. So we have something akin to payday lending in the United States. I then moved to Mozambique and discovered, that this is not, Mexico wasn't an isolated case, but such questionable practices were happening in Mozambique also. So I decided to try my hand at working in a microfinance investment fund. And that was when I really began to realize that the problems of microfinance are not necessarily isolated to a few rogue operators, but are in fact endemic to the entire sector. So at a certain point, I began to realize that, we had drifted off our course and something had to be done.
And part of what had to be done was the writing of this book, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. Barrett Kohler is the publisher. My guest is author Hugh Sinclair, joining us by phone for the first half of the program. You also have a website, microfinancetransparency.com. I sort of think about this book sort of like John Perkins, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and your book is Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic. What happened when you started looking at the sort of the dark side of this industry that you had thrown in your lot with?
Well, it's quite difficult to raise alarm bells within the microfinance sector because it operates very carefully to protect its own interests. Yeah, so there is there is a lot of PR and spin and misinformation that is presented to the outside world in order to keep what is now vast sums of money flowing into the sector. And any kind of criticism is treated very harshly. So there have been a number of cases of whistleblowers, of academics, of journalists trying to investigate transparently what is really going on and finding themselves coming up against a wall. So I first came up against a wall in Mozambique when I discovered that the bank that we were working with, which was actually owned by World Relief, the DC-based large NGO, they were using client savings. This is the savings deposited by some of the poorest women on the planet in often rural areas of Mozambique, using these for their operating expenses to pay salaries, often quite generous salaries. And I raised alarm bells about this and said, you know, not only is this of questionable legality, but morally speaking, it's very uncertain that we're on that we're actually assisting the poor here. And I was fired from that company. And the repercussions ever since then have been very serious. The sector operates with a certain set of rules, and as long as you toe the party line, you know, you can have a nice life and you can boast at dinner parties of how you're assisting the poor and earn a reasonable salary and fly around the world collecting air miles. But the moment you start to criticize it, there is a very violent backlash. And this is one of the things which I've come across time and time again. But eventually I just decided, you know, this can't go on. This is really unfair for a number of reasons. It's unethical. We're deceiving not only the poor, but also the citizens of the United States and Europe, who are often generously contributing to the microfinance sector with their savings and their pensions and their investments in a belief that they're doing something good. Whereas in actual fact, the truth is a lot more murky.
My guest is Hugh Sinclair, the book Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic. Eventually, your path led you to become a source for a New York Times expose of problems in the microfinance industry. And let's kind of chronicle a couple of those problems which you go through here in the book. Maybe first starting with Mexico and the story of the social bank that went public.
Yes, Compartamos is the name of the bank. It's one of the most famous or should I say notorious institutions in the entire microfinance sector. But by some, it is heralded as the proof that microfinance works. Compartamos Bank has recently been found by, amongst other people, the noted U.S. academic David Rudman at the Center for Global Development for charging interest rates of up to 195% per year. So if you put that into context, you know, U.S. citizens paying 10% or 15% may struggle to repay their mortgage, and yet somehow we expect the poor to pay not 50%, not 100%, but closer to 200% interest. Now, not surprisingly, this institution is phenomenally profitable. It would be hard not to be profitable with those sorts of margins. So in 2008, they decided to do a stock market flotation, an IPO. This was the first IPO that had taken place in microfinance history, and it was very, very oversubscribed and made a few individual people and the IFC and one US NGO called Acción an extremely generous return on their investment. Acción made a $1 million investment, and the value of their shares at the IPO was $270 million. So at this point, it began to attract the attention of the likes of Wall Street, who suddenly realized, there is actually not just some fringe development tool called microfinance working with these poor people, but there is in fact an extremely profitable sector that Wall Street hadn't yet tapped into.
You cite it as about a $70 billion industry now, right?
The current estimate is about $70 billion of all the private capital in the microfinance sector. And when we think of the interest rates that these people are charging, it's difficult to get data on the average interest rates because a lot of institutions attempt to hide their interest rates because they are embarrassingly high in many cases. But most estimates would suggest that it's somewhere under, on average, under 50% worldwide. So with a $70 billion sector, we have to answer the question, if we are extracting something of the order of perhaps $30 billion a year in interest from the poor, what benefit are we actually having? Is it worth the price that we are charging them for it? And the evidence to date is not very encouraging.
We're speaking with Hugh Sinclair, author of Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor, brand new out, and joining us by phone for the first half of this program. Tell us the story of the Nigerian LAPO, the Lift Above Poverty organization, and what was happening there.
Yes, this institution is one of the largest microfinance banks actually in Africa, certainly in West Africa, referred to as LAPO. I was working at the Dutch microfinance fund, Triple Jump, which manages funds from the commercial banks, from NGOs such as Oxfam, Novip. I was sent down to LAPO to assist them with some operational problems that they were having. And I discovered that, in fact, the bank was, you know, they had a number of family members in the management team, even operating as external auditors, which is not a particularly good sign of governance. They were charging extremely high interest rates, over 100% a year. They had chronic client desertion, which is to say the clients were abandoning the bank quite rapidly. And there were cases of frauds. There were a number of problems with the institution. But the fund that I was working with was happy to invest in this institution, and you know, which I found, you know, simply embarrassing at the time. But then some months later, I believe it was about 7 months later, the same investment fund, Triple Jump, took some money from the Calvert Foundation based in D.C. Calvert had raised money from the U.S. general public, and they had given this money to Triple Jump to invest on their behalf. So what Triple Jump had done was they had discreetly invested this money in LAPO and hadn't entirely explained to Calvert what we had found out in the meantime, what we knew to be the case within this Nigerian bank. So I confronted the management, suggesting that what we had deceived Calvert Foundation, and that this was not ethical, and that Calvert, because it had raised money from Microplace, a lending platform in the US, was actually under SEC regulation. So we were treading on very thin legal ice with this. So I was asked to leave the office promptly, and I was then issued with an ultimatum. I was given 7 days to sign a new contract, which would offer me a pay rise on the condition that I signed additional confidentiality clauses and promised formally to never speak badly or to mention anything to do with the operations of Triple Jump. Needless to say, I refused to sign that. We went to court, and I'm pleased to say that I won the court case. And all this information, what I've done is placed it on the website so that anyone who wants to look into the details of these claims is able to download the original documents and confirm for themselves what exactly happened.
And that website is microfinancetransparency.com. My guest is Hugh Sinclair, the book Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, taking your calls at 256-2001. We have a caller holding on the line. And hello, caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes. That's you. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. Hello, is this me?
Yes, it is. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sinclair, for sharing with us. And good day, your terrifying experience. But in a way, you know, that's how capitalism works, has always been working, in my opinion, like that. First. Second, I think this is, these, how can I say, companies, let's put it that way, make organized crime pale in comparison. And I think they should be prosecuted according to the RICO statute, which is the statute, the law, federal law, that sent many mafia criminals to jail here in the States. Point number one. Point number two aren't laws against usury. Usury. The whole idea that made so many people wealthy in past centuries was usury. Is it ever possible that they get away with all these ugly threats, again, mafia style? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that call. And Hugh Sinclair?
Yes, the caller has raised some very interesting issues. Looking at the first point, this is just how capitalism works. Well, it shouldn't come as much surprise to citizens of the United States and of Europe when we've seen the consequences of what is apparently a regulated financial sector controlling our capitalist society that has not performed particularly well and has led to, you know, untold suffering and endless scandals. When you take these same people and this same ideology, and you place it in a completely unregulated environment, such as in Africa or in Latin America or in parts of Asia, it shouldn't really come as much of a surprise that abuses take place. Abuses take place in America. So one of the things is that we really need to improve the regulation of the microfinance sector. Now, the caller then suggested, you know, why aren't these institutions being prosecuted? Well, the unfortunate situation is that they're not being prosecuted because there is no one looking at the microfinance sector. There is no regulatory oversight. In developing countries, there are some countries, particularly in South America, where regulation is actually pretty good. And what we see is that microfinance is ethical. But this is the exception rather than the rule. Most of these people are operating completely in a completely unregulated environment. And in the United States, when people invest in one of these funds or lending platforms, they may believe that they're protected by some regulator, but the reality in practice is that they're not. Now, moving on to the question of usurious interest rates, I think most people would say that an interest rate of over 100% or 195% is usurious, yeah? Particularly when it's money which is lent to poor, vulnerable people who might not be as financially literate to understand the situation that they're getting into. But the microfinance sector has been very adamant in not defining what is extortionate. They refer to the law and they say there is no law, there is no one, there is no written word that says this interest rate is extortionate. Therefore, we can charge whatever we want. So they can get away with it. That is the problem.
In the introduction to the, or the foreword, I guess, to the book done by David Corton, he quotes Muhammad Yunus, founder of the Grameen Bank, from a 2011 New York Times op-ed. And he says when he founded the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh in 1983, he never imagined that one day microcredit would give rise to its own breed of loan sharks, but it has. So even Muhammad Yunus, the founder of this microcredit movement, is seeing this issue. How did this happen to the microfinance movement? How did the loan sharks and the usurious lenders gain precedence in this industry?
Well, I think the answer to that is actually very simple. It's profit, the quest for profit. Muhammad Yunus's bank and banks which actually practice what Muhammad Yunus preaches, which are disappointingly few and far between, tend not to be very profitable, because if you actually treat clients well, if you charge them reasonable interest rates, if you offer them advice and services, these are all expensive, and they increase your expenses and they reduce your income. So it leads to less profitable institutions. So the unfortunate situation that we have now is that the vast majority of private capital seeking to invest in microfinance institutions doesn't necessarily reward the good players. It seeks out the maximum profit that it can. And this profit comes from one simple source, the poor. Now, if we actually practice what Muhammad Yunus preached, then we would be in a far better situation than we are in at the moment. But the problem is more complicated, because if you actually look at what Muhammad Yunus says, in his own bank in Bangladesh, the interest rates are very reasonable. They're closer to 24% of that order of magnitude, which is some of the cheapest microfinance in the world. But if we look at this institution, the LAPO organization in Nigeria, we see in repeated rating reports, The New York Times uncovered it. There have been specialist NGOs that focus on calculating the real interest rates. We see interest rates of, in, you know, 110, 120. The highest estimate has been at 144. Now, the problem with this is, you know, one asks, how did this ever come about? But if we look into the details of the investors in this institution in Nigeria, we find that one of them is, in fact, Grameen Foundation USA, based in the United States, which is a sister organization of Grameen. Muhammad Yunus sits on their board, and in actual fact, they are using the name of Grameen and the good image of Grameen and the impression that we are all practicing what Muhammad Yunus preached, which, if only it were the case. And in actual fact, they are also providing capital to institutions which lend at rates of over 100%. So I think what happened with Muhammad Yunus is that although he's heralded as something of a leader in the sector, that's all we do. We herald him, we point to him, we use him on the websites, we quote his nice comments, but then what we actually go and do in practice, often in the name of microfinance and poverty alleviation, is very different. And we do that because the profit motive has just permeated the entire sector. That is the problem.
Now, you know, we talk about the Grameen Bank as sort of the origin of microfinance, but I wanted to just run this by you because I think there's a couple of other interesting origins, at least here in the United States, in our relationship with microfinance. And one is the Central America solidarity movements of the 1980s, which led to both the creation of the fair trade coffee industry and people seeking to invest in smaller projects, and also some of the development of micro lending in Nicaragua, particularly working with women's organizations in that country. And another, I think, origin of the way that we perceive microfinance in the U.S. is coming out of the anti-apartheid movement, when we went from the boycotting of South Africa to the boycotting of investing in socially responsible funds. And Calvert, that you mentioned, was very involved in this. I remember a cartoon they ran back in the 80s of a South African black man wrapped in chains of money. And so these are also influences on the microfinance industry. And I guess the question that this would lead to is, you know, where is the moral component of the moral compass, if you will, of this microfinance industry, and how does it play out in the, I guess we'll say, the good microfinance model?
Well, you've touched on a very interesting point, because it is precisely that moral compass that we seem to have thrown out of the window. If you look at, for example, the amount of information which your average investor in microfinance is provided with in the United States, it's minimal. There's no transparency. No one really has any idea what happens to their money when it leaves the door. If we look at the efforts to regulate the sector, so far they have amounted to little more than self-regulation, often regulated by the very same people that have caused so many of the problems. We have the situation of the wolf guarding the sheep. So the problem is ultimately one of a lack of transparency, which enables people to present their activities as morally untouchable, and we're helping the poor, and we're assisting the entrepreneurial flair of the poor, and they can present this image, and that is moral. It is ethical. It's really nice. It appeals to us. We like to hear this. We like to see these stories. We see a few photographs of a woman with a goat, and we think, yes, that's a really good idea. I'm going to support this. But the problem is that there's no way that we can actually find out whether that is what is happening in the field, in the developing countries. And the fact of the matter is that it's not. But this information doesn't reach the mainstream media and the televisions of the U.S. citizens, so they never get to hear this message, because the people who are controlling the flow of the information are the same people that are causing so many of the problems. So because we've got this total lack of transparency, they can just present whatever image they want to the outside world and claim to be doing this wonderful thing which is so moral and so ethical, and in actual fact practice something completely different, and no one's going to be any the wiser. So until we really start looking at what is actually happening in the field, then we're not going to make any progress. But if you look at when the mainstream media, and two newspapers spring to mind, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, when you look at what they have published about the actual realities of microfinance, they are devastating, devastatingly critical. But the microfinance sector employs very powerful lobbyists. It has a large PR campaign. All these companies have very carefully honed PR experts and PR strategists to maintain this myth so that we must always present this image. And it's just, it's very difficult to actually explain to people what is really happening on the ground. So what I'm trying to do in the book is actually to not say, oh, all microfinance is bad, but ultimately the book is, you know, potentially most relevant for the U.S. investors who have maybe done some loans on Kiva or have maybe put some of their pension into the Calvert Foundation. And to read the book and realize, huh, there is a difference between good and bad microfinance. And when it's bad, it's very bad. How can I arm myself so that I know how to make sure that my money goes to a good institution and not a bad institution? Because right now, there's no way of knowing the difference.
And in fact, in the book, you have a whole section where you give advice to those interested in investing, to those microfinance funds, to management people, and to the poor as well. You have some advice there about how to think about taking these loans when they are offered. The book is called Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. Barrett Kohler is the publisher. Hugh Sinclair is my guest. Hugh, I know you have to go, but do you have a second to take one last question from a caller on the line?
Certainly, certainly.
Let's go to the phones for this last question with our guest, Hugh Sinclair. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. I work with artisans in Guatemala and to a lesser degree in Nicaragua, and I do see some individual groups that seem to work with the artisans as part of a total package of empowering them and another tool. Are these likely to be more, do good microfinance, or are you speaking primarily of the big investor-type microfinance, or how do you choose microfinance that does what it should be doing?
Okay, thank you very much for that call. Hugh?
Yes, I'm vaguely familiar with the Guatemala market, but I've worked extensively in Nicaragua. And I should stress that not all microfinance is bad. There are some really good grassroots organizations, and particularly those that are focused on a particular section of the society, whether that's artisans or the agricultural sector. But the key thing to look at is, on the one hand, the interest rates is important, but it's not the only factor. What sort of treatment, how do they treat their clients? What other services are they offering? The question to ask is, who has invested in those institutions? Because if you see the traditional profiteering microfinance investment funds investing in an institution, that is often an alarm bell on its own. But the real problem is, if you find a very good ethical microfinance institution in, you know, rural Nicaragua, for example, although it's very likely that they're doing a beneficial job, the problem is, when they try to grow their operations and go to the international investors and say, look, we're having a really good impact on poverty, we're really helping these artisans, would you be interested in investing in us or lending us some more money so that we can expand the scale of our operations? The first question will be, well, how profitable are you? What's your return on equity? What are your gross profit margins? And if they're not very good, the good institutions will really struggle to find, you know, investors. And so that's the problem. The game is stacked against the good players. They just find it so difficult to grow, and they soon get swamped by the very large players. Nicaragua is a classic case because it actually led to the entire downfall of the microfinance sector in 2008 as a grassroots rebellion just said, you know, we've had enough of this microfinance. It's not doing anything to help us, and we're going to stop repaying. When you had 5 million people saying that, the entire sector collapsed. Mm-hmm. It's a very good question, and there are good microfinance institutions out there. You just need to look very, very thoroughly and very carefully. It's looking for a needle in a haystack.
And the book is Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic. Again, the website, microfinancetransparency.com. www.hughsinclair.com. Hugh Sinclair, thank you so much for joining us today on A Public Affair, and appreciate your comments and your work.
Thank you very much, Norman.
And you're listening to A Public Affair. My name is Norman Stockwell. I'm your host today on the program. We're going to take a little tiny bit of a musical break as we get ready for our next guest, Dennis Marker.
You examine the terms of the deal. A car is always waiting. Other hands turn the wheel. The doors slide open before you. The doors slide shut behind. Other hands carry your luggage. Weightier matters engage your mind. You take the gold out of the earth. You throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in. The wheels must never stop turning. The machine must be a...
Leon Rosselson and Roy Bailey there. Who reaps the profits? Who pays the price? Recorded back in 1983 at the Vancouver Folk Festival by Gary Crystal. And you're listening to A Public Affair. And in the second half of the program, we're speaking with Dennis Marker, author of the brand new book, 50 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves from Ronald Reagan to the Tea Party. And 15 Steps is the publisher, and that's the website. Sorry, the15steps.com is the website. And Dennis Marker, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi, Norman. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Very, very pleased to have you with us. Let's start out with sort of the key question. The book is 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves. Who is and what is the middle class?
Well, what I do in the book is, and let me just say that the whole book is written for what I call the middle class, and so it's a short book, and it's a book for people who maybe don't even have time to sit down and read a long book. And so in terms of the definition of middle class, if you go and Google it, you'll find every sociologist, every economist has a different version of what that is. And so what I did in the book is make it as simple as possible, and I say, really, what Occupy Wall Street did in defining the 99% is close to what the middle class is. And what that means is, in the United States, we are a classless society. No, we think, or a lot of people think, we're a classless society. So if you go talk to an art gallery owner who maybe makes a fortune, what we would consider a fortune, or someone working at McDonald's, both of those people would consider themselves middle class. So what I do in the book is simply say anyone beyond the homeless or near homeless up to the top 5%, you know, and I explain. Let's say, okay, we could say the bottom 10% are really not the middle class and the top 10% are not the middle class. But if we just take the 99%, that's to who I'm writing.
And the book is 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves from Ronald Reagan to the Tea Party Movement. And in the book, you go through those 15 steps, and they're pretty pretty basic and pretty devastating 15 steps. And you say these 15 policies have been advocated starting with Ronald Reagan's election in 1980 and going right up to the Tea Party movement of today. Several of them are about changing the way people think about things. The first one is the takeover of the media.
Well, that's right. That's right. And one of the things a lot of people in the U.S. don't realize is one of our common myths is we didn't always have a middle class, and therefore we don't always have to have one. And so the reason we had a middle class was because after the Industrial Revolution, workers realized they were needed and demanded rights, and that led us to the labor struggles of the 18th and early 1900s. And the initial response of the people at the top, we call the rich, was not to say, oh, you're right, I'm going to share more of my wealth. Instead, what they did was everything they could to try to put down this movement, this idea of a middle class, and that including violence. But what happened is that during these labor struggles, a balance was reached where the owners realized they needed the workers and the workers realized they were needed. And this balance that was the middle class lasted right up until the time of the Reagan Revolution. And then, all of a sudden, the U.S. historically no longer needed a middle class, or in particular, the people at the top, what I call the corporate feudalists, no longer needed a middle class. So then the question becomes, if you didn't want one in the first place, and you've lived with them for all these years, and it's become commonly accepted practice, we're going to have this middle class, how do you get rid of it? So that gets to your question. Sort of the background is important. So that's right. All of these 15 steps were put together to convince the middle class to eliminate themselves, to accept their own demise. Because if 30 years ago you had simply announced, you being the corporate feudalist, the people at the top, that we figured out with international communication and international transportation and automation, we no longer need a U.S. middle class because we can outsource our jobs to the cheapest labor force anywhere in the world. If you had announced that to the middle class, they would have revolted in a way that would have made Occupy Wall Street look really little. And so the question becomes, if you want to get rid of the middle class and you can't tell them that's what you're doing, what can you do? So that gets to the 15 steps.
Right. And of course, they include things like the campaigns to vilify unions, which we are very familiar with here in Wisconsin. Also teaching people to hate government, promoting privatization, deregulation, et cetera. I mean, you've sort of addressed this a little bit, but, you know, how did in 30 short years the corporate feudalists, as you call them, basically convince people to vote against their own interests?
Right. And so you mentioned the first one. The first one in the book is controlling the media. Now, as I say in the book, every dictator knows if you're going to control a population, you need to control the media. So if you're going to convince the middle class to accept their own demise, first step is to control the media. And they took several actions right from the get-go, beginning with the Reagan administration, which was they started, they had something called the Office of Public Diplomacy, which really early on in the Reagan administration went around and monitored journalists and actually took them to task, not if they were inaccurate, but if they were deemed to be against U.S. interest, which at that time meant being against the Reagan administration's interest. But they also started this whole thing of the liberal bias of the media. Excuse me. And so they told the average people, don't trust the media because it's too liberal. They also did this whole deregulation thing where after they deregulated the media, one giant corporation could own thousands of media outlets, which before deregulation, an individual corporation or individual billionaire could only own a very small segment of the media. Now they've changed the rules so that one individual or one corporation can own a lot more of it. Also, they got rid of the Fairness Doctrine. And the Fairness Doctrine, in its most basic form, said that on controversial issues where we can't prove one side or the other's the truth, the news organization is responsible to give both sides of an event, which would mean if you talk about the lead-up to the Gulf War, before the Fairness Doctrine, you would have had to say, well, some people say there's weapons of mass destruction, but here there are a lot of other people who don't say that. But because the Fairness Doctrine was gone, you could simply have this propaganda lead-up to the war where the only side that was covered, which was the false side, which is with Saddam Hussein had all these weapons of mass destruction. And that's connected to step two in my book, which is the creation of the whole Rush Limbaugh and especially what I call Foxaganda, which is the Fox News Network. From the very beginning, the Fox agenda has been a very conservative agenda. I call it the corporate feudal agenda. Before you got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, you could not have had a Fox News, not a network giving out false, provenly false information for all of these years. They would have been responsible to cover both sides. And obviously, if you watch Fox or if you look at any of the studies that show people who watch Fox know less than people who watch any other news, and the most recent study, 2011 university study, actually found that people who watch Fox News is their sole source of information no less than people who watch or listen to no news at all. I mean, that's the classic definition of propaganda. people who think they know what's going on, but in fact have no idea.
My guest is Dennis Marker. The book, 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves from Ronald Reagan to the Tea Party Movement the past three-plus decades. I have a caller holding on the line, and hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I guess I'd like to test my own theory with you, and that is that the reason for part of the reason for the problem is that the American dream has been so well sold, hook, line, and sinker to the American public, the concept that you shouldn't resent the very wealthy because you too have an equal chance, the same as they did, to become just as wealthy. And then there's the corollary that if you're not able to succeed that way, it's because there's something wrong within you. It's not the system or that there's inherent inequities. It's because of some personal failing within you. And I believe that that so-called dream has, you know, permeated the American psyche for so long. And I believe that's one reason why people are still willing and capable of voting against their own economic self-interest. And I'll take my any comments off the air, and thanks for taking the call.
Okay, thank you for that call. Dennis Marker?
Yes. Well, thank you. And I talked specifically about what the caller, I didn't get his name, but exactly what he said. There's this myth. In fact, if you look at the language, with starting with the Reagan administration, one of the things he said, and he said often, this being Reagan himself, was we're all in this together. But no, we're not. If you look at what's happened in terms of wealth distribution in the past 30 years, the people at the top are now up to pre-Great Depression levels. The people at the top 10%, and I have a chart that shows this very simply in the book, but before the Great Depression, the top 10% controlled 50% of the nation's wealth. After the Great Depression, that number went down to the 30s. And stayed in the 30s consistently all the way from the end of the Great Depression until the election of Ronald Reagan. And then we see a very dramatic increase in the percentage of wealth controlled by the top 10%. And, of course, if you actually break it down further, the top 1% and the top 0.1%. But anyway, you just look at this chart and it flatlines. Wealth distribution is the same until Ronald Reagan, and then it shoots up. And so while they're saying we're all in this together, the reality is that the people at the top, the Mitt Romneys of the world, you will, have done incredibly well, while everyone else has remained constant or gone downhill.
The pie
has simply shifted. So the amount of pie controlled by that top 10%, the top 1%, is much larger, which means that just means leaves that much less for everyone else.
My guest is Dennis Marker, the book 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism. And, you know, we talk about the Reagan Revolution, and it's interesting. I kind of see the Reagan Revolution in part as sort of moving the center to the right. It's like during the Reagan years, the 1980s, what happened was that what we used to call the center continually moved farther and farther to the right, and now we have a situation where many Republican politicians will actually vote against their own interests in order to block a bill because it moves that agenda further to the right. What do you say to that, Dennis Marker?
Right, completely correct. I say that is 100% right, and I talk about that in the book as well. They actually very cleverly talked about, you know, this whole idea that they considered themselves, or they talked about themselves, they being the Reagan administration, about being the center. But what they did was move the center so far to the right that by the time Bill Clinton was elected, Bill Clinton, who was known as being a conservative Democrat and actually was supported by this group called, I think, the Democratic Leadership Council,
right,
whose whole goal was to put a conservative Democrat in office, they succeeded. So they got what everybody knew up until the election of Bill Clinton was a conservative Democrat. But the Republicans clearly, intentionally labeled him as a liberal. And so you take a guy who's a conservative Democrat and then you call him a liberal. And so that means that if Clinton, who was elected as a conservative Democrat by the Democrats, is a liberal, then you've just shifted the middle instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing this consistently for 30 years.
The book is 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, taking your calls at 256-2001. Also, the website, the15steps.com. We have another caller holding on the line. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like the author to address two factors in this equation, and one is the racism internecine factor in the lower and middle class, and the other thing is I'm curious as to what he has been thinking about just how far this can go before the engine of prosperity that is sustained by a strong middle class simply implodes, and what we're going to be left with if that occurs.
Okay, thank you for that call.
Well, in terms of the racism, I mean, racism is always, it's a great thing. It's one of many things that the people at the top use to have the people that are not at the top, meaning everyone else, fighting with each other. If you're fighting about racism, well, that's great. If you have people upset because we have a black president, well, maybe they're not focusing on how you're picking their pocket. It's kind of like the game that you see in the cities with the little game where you put the pea underneath one of the cups and you slide the cup around, and everyone's so fascinated by which cup the bean is under, they don't realize that you've got someone else who's part of this whole operation going around and picking everyone's pocket. So racism is definitely used, and we've seen it clearly in the past 4 years. So, yes, racism a part of it. The other question...
How far can it go?
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. One of the things prior to this, I mean, I've been thinking about this for 30 years because I thought they would make these claims, the Reagan administration would make these claims to get elected, but they wouldn't do it, meaning that I thought 30 years ago they actually needed a middle class. Well, so how far can it go? I think right now what you're seeing is that the corporations were before, as I said, international communications and transportation, they actually needed to make the products here, and this was the big consumer base. But now you have a company maybe based in the United States, but a multinational corporation that's producing their products in, say, a Saipan sweatshop. They have not only whatever market they have for the people who have anything left, any money left in the U.S. that they can go to Walmart and buy it, but they also have consumers in India. They can have consumers in China. And they can sell the same product for a lot less in those countries because they're making it for so little. And so I would say that the way I talk about it in the book, and the reason I use the term corporate feudalism, two reasons. One is everyone knows what feudalism is, and two, we move to that system. And so we have a system much closer to what you may have seen in the Philippines under Marcos, for example, or in El Salvador before the revolution when you had the oligarchy. You had this class that of 5 or 10% of the people who controlled everything, and everyone else had nothing. And I think I can see us, if we don't turn this around, going to that situation where what we have now, the U.S. middle class, is brought down to the level of what they call the middle class in, say, India or China or even Saipan, which means almost, you know, having very little access to the resources needed to live what we called previously a middle-class life.
You know, it was interesting. Political folk singer Billy Bragg was here last week, and in his concert he talked about the fact that capitalism has kind of run out of ideas and that they're continuing to sort of pull the same levers that they always had, but they're not getting the same response. And he saw the Occupy Wall Street movement that you mentioned earlier as being where a lot of the new ideas are, and saw some possibility and hope in that.
Well, that's right. I think I would say that at this point that the corporate feudalists have gotten control of the enthusiasm and momentum for Occupy Wall Street. And first, you know, it was the classic thing. First they ignored it, then they made fun of it, then they cracked down brutally in a couple of places. But it was always, what can we do to stop this message? But the message that got out with Occupy Wall Street was the message of wealth distribution, directly talking about what your first caller said, which was that we're not all in this together. So the whole purpose of my book is a very simple thing for the middle class to read and get that point. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're not all this in this together. Some people have been winning winning in a big way at the same time that the U.S. middle class is losing.
And the book is...
Yes, the ideas have to come from outside of traditional capitalism, because if you take capitalism at its most basic form, which is what we try to do now in the U.S., which is deregulated capitalism, it's always going to lead to this. And the only way that any version of capitalism can work is if you have strong regulations, like the regulations they have in Scandinavian countries, for example, where, yes, you can own Lego, you can own Volvo, you're going to pay a huge amount of taxes, and we are going to provide for all of the citizens. So we have this basic contentment of all of our citizens because of health care for everyone, education for everyone. You don't get out of school with a $300,000 debt when you live in Sweden or Denmark. And so the reason that they've been able to maintain their middle class is because of the strong, consistent regulations they have on capitalism.
And the book is The 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, the website, the15steps.com. My guest, Dennis Marker. Time to squeeze in one last caller. And hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. Sir, I'm sure you have written another well-articulated and compelling work proving that water is wet. Of course capitalism is corrupt. We all know that they appropriate everything for themselves that they possibly can. When markets contract, when they expand, they throw crumbs. Okay, we have to keep going over this. The point is, as you said earlier, is unless we turn this around, we never get to the discussion about strategy and tactics. In the last recall election of Governor Walker, almost 40% of union households voted for him. The fact is that the union movement is as much part of the problem as the corporate movement is. They do not accept the fact of the class struggle. They have adopted the completely false theory of the brotherhood of capital and labor. This nonsense has been afoot since before World War II. The point is, what do we do about it? Once we abandon direct action, we funnel all our efforts into a corrupt political system that is a dead end. That's the question as I see it. Will you respond to that, please?
Okay, thank you very much for that call. And in the last couple of minutes that we have, Dennis Marker, what shall we do?
Sure. I actually do go through strategy and tactics in my book. And one of the things I say, and I believe this is true, I'm getting a huge response from this book, which is you will not have a union member who reads this book and votes conservative again. In fact, I would argue that you will not have a middle-class person who reads this book and votes conservative again. And the book is just an easy read, but you get to the end, and I had a guy in Kansas I was doing an interview with, and he said, my grandmother, who's 80 years old and has always been a conservative, read the book and instantly got it. And so one thing you can do is read this book. The second thing sounds self-serving, but I believe it's true. The second thing is I go through strategy and tactics and lay out an entire framework. I don't try to give all the answers, obviously. That's what movements like Occupy Wall Street need to discuss it, but there are some things that are instant that we have to do. We have to scrap our entire electoral system. And whether we go with a European-style system, which is all the money out of politics, public financing, no opt-out, or we go to the Athenian system, where they invented democracy, which was to simply pick people by congressional district, by lottery.
As long as they were rich white male citizens, I think was the limit in the Athenian democracy.
For us, it would be anyone over, we'd pick an age, 18, 21, doesn't matter what the age is, and say, you're eligible. And what we would end up then was we'd have just as likely have a seamstress as a pipe fitter as a attorney owned by billionaires.
Okay, so we have to leave it. We have to leave it there, okay. Dennis Marker, because we're out of time. But the book, again, 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America's Middle Class to Eliminate Themselves, from Ronald Reagan to the Tea Party Movement. We didn't talk about the Tea Party, but you have a whole section on the Tea Party Movement. One Standard Press is the publisher. The15steps.com is the website. Thank you so much for being with us today on A Public Affair.
Thank you, Norman. Had a great time.